Well, good morning. We're at Luke chapter 21 this morning. Luke chapter 21. Susan and I, last 2 or 3 weeks, off and on, have been listening to sermons by R.C. Sproul and Alistair Begg. Those two, I remember. On this passage, Luke chapter 21 and Mark chapter 13 and Matthew chapter 24, which all covers the same thing. And I remember we listened to R.C., one of his sermons on this as he was preaching through the book of Luke, and got to the end of it, and I thought, yeah, I believe I've changed my mind about something. And agree with, you know, he convinced me of something. And the next day, I was reading through the text and through Matthew and stuff, the same thing, and told Susan that night, I said, I've changed my mind back the other way. And we listened to another sermon that night, and I was ready to change it again. So I thought what I would do is come this morning with 3 different sermons. In case I change my mind in the middle of one, I can set it aside and pick up another one. But if you ask me a year from now, I may believe something different than what I want to say this morning. But this is one of the most difficult passages, and about everybody that I read or listened to begins their message or their writing with this disclaimer that this is a very difficult passage to put together and to satisfy all the hard things about it. So it's hard to be dogmatic about it. But you'll see the same thing in Matthew 24 and Mark 13. A little different information, but basically the same thing if sometime you want to read it. And we're going to go through a lot of things, so I'm going to try to talk a little faster than I normally talk and see if we can cover some of this. You see, the first thing I've got is time indicator references, and I want to just mention those because there are several of them. We need to be aware of them. And we're going to be looking at, of course, Luke 21 in our text. And I'm going to back up and show you these things from beginning in verse 9, actually, where in verse 9 he says, these things must take place first, but the end does not immediately follow. So you see some indications of time there. He goes on, but before all these things, in verse 12, then in verse 20, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded, then the next one is in verse 24, Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot until the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Then in verse 26 and 27, the heavens will be shaken, and then will they see the Son of Man. Verse 28, coming with power and great glory, but when these things begin to appear. Then verse 31, when you see these things, know that the kingdom of God is near. And verse 32, perhaps the most critical verse of them all, which we're not going to be looking at today to any extent, this generation will not pass until all these things take place. Now there are we'll be looking at a lot of those time references as we go through there this morning. But there are various views and explanations of the text that I want to point out. The first one is this, that some say that this text demonstrates that Jesus was a false prophet. And they get that from verse 32, which says, this generation will not pass until all these things be fulfilled. Well, one of those things that apparently is talking about being fulfilled is that you would see the Son of Man coming in great power and glory. And that didn't occur, according to most everyone. And also that the signs from the stars, the sun and the moon and the stars, apparently didn't take place to the extent that people were willing to say this was a great sign. So, well, some say Jesus' prophecy didn't come true, therefore can't believe anything that he says. contrary to that and ironic with that is that other people say that this is one, this passage of scripture is one, contains one of the most detailed fulfillments of prophecy that there is, and that being the destruction of Jerusalem. Third thing is, some say that everything was fulfilled in 70 AD. Some, or number four, some emphasize it as a prophecy of Christ's return in the future and barely mention the destruction of Jerusalem. They're so excited about or honed in on Christ's return that the destruction of Jerusalem is just kind of a side note that they barely mention. Number five, some try to find an explanation that has an immediate fulfillment in 70 AD and a more significant fulfillment yet to come. My own journey through this passage of scripture and through end times and eschatological teaching has gone from number four. I was kind of born in that class of emphasizing Christ's return and just minimizing the destruction of Jerusalem. That's kind of where I started out in, you might say. It was in churches that kind of leaned that direction. And I know many of you have as well. But for myself, I've kind of purposely, as the years have gone by and I've studied, went from that to trying to go to number five, or finding myself at least in number five, where I not want to minimize the destruction of Jerusalem at all, but yet see something that appears not to have actually taken place yet. And then you notice what I've got there, trying desperately to stop there before I fall into number three, which says it's all fulfilled in 70 AD. All right, that's kind of the direction I find myself going, kicking and screaming. I really don't want to be there, but who knows. All right, one thing, that's number three. The thing I want to mention, first of all, is I assume that when Jesus is giving all this information to his disciples, that his primary objective is to answer their questions. They ask a question. The two questions that they ask, you see there, when will these things be? And what will be the sign that these things are about to take place? Well, what these things are they talking about? The destruction of the temple, particularly. Because Jesus had, they were there marveling at the temple. You remember that, verse 5 or something like that. And the temple was a grand thing. I don't think that I realize, maybe you have, I realize just how magnificent this building was. Josephus, in his writings, gives a detailed description of this temple. He tells you how long it was, how wide it was, how deep it was, what was here, what was there, about the temple being built on a hill that they leveled off during the years past to make it more accessible or make it bigger or whatever the case. Lots and lots of information that Josephus gives about the size of the temple, etc. Just to give you a few things, and he's got lots of stuff that would take me a week or two to figure it all out and to kind of draw a diagram or whatever to understand what he means by certain phrases and words. But the temple, if I understand it, was 150 foot tall. Y'all could comprehend 150 foot? Tall, that's like 15-story building, 150 foot wide across the front, and not quite as deep. In the front of the temple, there were 60-foot tall pillars, stone marble pillars, 60 foot tall, that were 6 foot in diameter, overlaid with gold. All right? They go up, and I assume that there was a little, not a little gable, but a gable up there that these pillars held up. And on that, somewhere up there, there are lots of sculpture going on with a vine and some grapes, clusters of grapes. Those clusters of grapes were as tall as a man, so the the grapes on that cluster are probably, I would assume, big as a volleyball perhaps or something like that, overlaid with gold, all of it, a magnificent building. If it had stood, if it had not been destroyed, they say it probably would have been one of the greatest wonders of the world that we all learned about in high school. But it didn't. But it was there when Jesus cleansed the temple. That's the temple that he cleansed. It was there as he's there, him and his disciples are there now, talking and teaching, and they come out, and the disciples marvel once again. I'll tell them how many times they've seen this thing, but it's still a magnificent and a marvel to look at. And they mentioned this, start a discussion with Jesus, and Jesus says, the day will come when everything you see here will be overturned. Not one stone will be left upon another. It will all be destroyed. Some of those stones were 60 foot long, 8 or 9 foot wide, 8 or 9 foot tall. Now, I cannot imagine how things like that were even made and put in place. But you said it will all be torn down. It'll all be gone. And I imagine that the disciples, Lord, they're not like us. We look in hindsight at all this. And they're sitting there looking at this, how in the world would that ever happen? And they're standing there in disbelief at what Jesus has just said. So they ask him, when's this going to happen? How will we know when it's about to happen? What will the signs be that it's about to take place? And that's what Jesus prompts Jesus' answer. Now, you see on your outline there that I've got something called the short version. This is verses 8 to 11, where Jesus says these words. He said, see to it that you be not misled, for many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and the time is at hand. Do not go after them. And when you hear of wars and disturbances, do not be terrified. For these things must take place first, but the end does not follow immediately. Then continued he by saying to them, nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes and in various places plagues and famines, and there will be terrors and great signs from heaven. Now I'm calling this a short version because Jesus says three or four things, just a brief description of these things. He says, many people will come in my day, in that day, claiming to be the Messiah. Don't be fooled by them. He says, don't be frightened. You're going to hear about wars or see wars and disturbances in the earth. Don't be frightened about them, because that's not the end. There will be widespread conflict between nations and kingdoms. That will occur. There will be earthquakes, famines, and great signs from heaven. So it sounds like it's just a short description of three or four things here. And then he says, but before all this. And then he starts, kind of like he backs up, starts giving you more detail. Now as we back up, start in verse 12, and give more detail, I want you to us to constantly kind of ask ourselves this question. Could this thing that we're fixing to talk about, we'll talk about several of them, could it have taken place? Or do we know that it was fulfilled by the time 70 AD and the destruction of Jerusalem came about? In other words, these things that he's going to prophesy, were they fulfilled before 70 AD or by the time Jerusalem was destroyed? So let's look at them. This will be on the next page there, description of the first signs you will see. So what does he say? But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you. Another thing I want you to notice through this all, that Jesus does not, he seems to not include himself in these things. Notice he doesn't say, but they will persecute us. But they will persecute you. And I wonder what the disciples were thinking. I mean, it seemed like they would have the question, where are you going to be? They're going to take us and persecute us, but are you going to be there too? All right. Now, I suspect that their lack, or at least of the record of their lack of verbalizing that question, is the same that they had before. There were times when Jesus told them the Son of Man must die and be killed, but will raise again the third day. And there was one instance at least where it said, the text says, the disciples did not ask him what he meant. They didn't understand that, but they were afraid to ask. And I think that that is perhaps what we have here. They hear Jesus saying they're going to take you and they're going to persecute you. And they may wonder where he's going to be, but they don't discuss it. They don't bring it up. Okay, let's go on. Verse 12. Delivering you to the synagogues and prisons. But the key word there is synagogues. Why would they deliver them to the synagogues and not to the Roman officials? It's because the synagogues were the first stop if you're trying to get somebody in trouble. The Jewish leaders, the religious leaders, were also involved in the civil magistrates or the civil officials, authorities in the town, in the region, in Israel. So the first stop to carry someone to the law was the religious law, was the church or the temple. Now, Jesus is talking to his disciples. He says they're going to take you, persecute you, and carry you before the synagogues. When did that start taking place? From the time Jesus is telling them this. About 2 months. About 2 months from now, that's going to start. All right, so that easily happened. We know it happened. You can see it in the New Testament, in the book of Acts particularly. Delivering you to synagogues and prisons, bringing you before kings and governors for my name's sake. Now, verses 13 and 14, Jesus says this. It will lead you to an opportunity for your testimony. So here's what he says. So make up your minds not to prepare beforehand to defend yourself. That sounds a little backwards, don't it? We want to prepare for something if we know it's coming. Jesus says, don't prepare for what you might say. Don't worry. In other words, don't worry about what your answers are going to be. Verse 15, for I will give you utterance and wisdom which none of your opponents will be able to resist or refute. Now, this particular idea is one of the most abused things in the Bible. Because you always hear people say, well, the Bible says don't worry about what your answer is because he'll give you an answer in that day. No, the Bible didn't tell you that. The Bible told the disciples that. Jesus told the disciples that. That doesn't mean that it applies to me or to you. My dad always gave, I remember an account that he gave. When I was a little boy, I don't remember this, but I remember the preacher, pastor of a little country church where we lived. The pastor was talking about this, and that he said he could this passage applied to a lot of things. One of them was him. He could get up to preach and not have a text, but God would give him something to say. And somebody challenged him on it, so he was going to do it the next Sunday. And so he opened his Bible and stuck his finger somewhere, you know, not knowing where he opened it, and preached the sermon. And I was, by the time I heard this story, I was a teenager, I guess. And I asked my dad, I said, well, how was it? He said, well, it sounded like somebody that just opened the Bible and stuck their finger down and started talking. So I don't think the people were very impressed by that. But that this idea is commonly misused. Verse 16, he says, but you will be delivered up even by parents and brothers and relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. Did this take place before the destruction of Jerusalem? It did. It certainly did. People who became Christians were cut off by their families, ratted on by their families to the Jewish authorities. All right? when Peter and James, you remember them being carried before the Sanhedrin, and they gave an account of their life, really the basic history of Jesus of Nazareth and what he came to do and how he fulfilled the Old Testament. And the authorities, our text says here, they will not be able to resist you or to refute what you say. How do people respond to an argument when they can't refute it? Anger. They get mad. They may curse you and call you names. And I always wanted to say, and how does that, what kind of argument is that? That's no argument to call me names. To assault you. You remember what Peter and James said, or was it John? As they stood there, they said, all we know is what we have heard. Here is what Jesus said. All right? It goes on down. Now look at the end of verse 16. It says, many of you will be put to death. Verse 17, you will all be hated by all on account of my name. Verse 18, yet not a hair of your head will perish. By your endurance you will gain your lives. Now when I read the verse, yet not a hair of your head will perish, I assume that means that they're not going to hurt you. They can't touch your body and beat you up or kill you or whatever. But two verses back, he said they will put some of you to death. So how do we square those two things? Some of you will be put to death, yet not a hair of your head will perish. I think the idea that Jesus is telling them is this. They are going to be alone. That is, he is not going to be with them. And they may have anxiety, or right now thinking about that ahead, they're going to have anxiety about what's going on. And Jesus is saying, even if they kill you, I am with you. I am your Lord. They cannot destroy your life. You have eternal life. Take joy in the fact that death is nothing to you, even if that's what happens. So those are some things that he tells them there. And all of these things that we just read through verse 19 happened long time before, or years before they started happening, years before the Jerusalem was destroyed and the temple was torn down. So these things we know were fulfilled prior to the temple being destroyed. So let's go on. Some more signs that he gives. And these things, it appears to be, are given now in from verse 12 on down in a chronological order. Verse 20, he says, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded, when you see Jerusalem surrounded, what does he say do? Recognize that her desolation is at hand. When you see armies surrounding Jerusalem, you know the time is near. He says in verse 21, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. And those that are in the midst of the city, depart. Let not those who are in the country go into the city. Now, back in those days and in the early years of our country, Daniel Boone went from wherever, North Carolina, Virginia, wherever, west to Kentucky. And one of the first things they did was built a fort. Out in the western, on the frontier, they built forts. The army built forts. People were settling outside the forts. And when there was a threat of an Indian uprising, the cavalry or somebody, or they would somehow get word to these people, hey, the Indians are on their way to destroy everything, come to the fort. Why would they go to the fort? Because it is a more safe place. They can defend themselves better in the fort. I've seen Daniel Boone do that a bunch on the show, so I know how that worked, all right? So here they are, they go to the fort, and that's the way it was in this day in Israel. The people who were outside the temple or Jerusalem, outside Jerusalem, the Romans didn't, when they came to Titus, when they first came to start destroying this, they didn't just come straight to Jerusalem. As they came across the land that was there and that belonged to the Israelites, they were destroying it as they came. So these people could see ahead what's happening, and they flee to Jerusalem, get inside the walls, 150-foot tall walls around the city. That is one reason there are so many people in Jerusalem when this all takes place. Another reason is because it was 3 days from Passover, I believe it was three or four days, when they surrounded the place, and people were already there for the Passover. And the most common thing that people would have been told would be, go to Jerusalem. Get inside the walls, and you'll be better protected. But Jesus, here in our passage, tells them just the opposite. When you see the armies coming to surround Jerusalem, flee. Flee to the mountains. Get away. It's interesting that Josephus and another historian that I can't remember his name mentioned that when the Jerusalem was destroyed, there was like 1.1 million people who died. 1.1 million people who died. But Josephus says, not one Christian. I don't know how accurate that is, but it's apparently was common knowledge in the history of that time that the Christians were gone. Why were they gone? I would imagine because of this verse right here. Jesus told them, when you see these things coming, get out. Get out and get away. He says in verse 22, for these are the days of vengeance. We're going to come back to this verse. In order that all things which are written may be fulfilled. These are days of vengeance. The question I have is, whose vengeance? In order that all things which are written may be fulfilled. He goes on, woe to those who are with child, those who nurse babes in those days. There will come great distress on the land and wrath to this people. Verse 24, and they will fall by the edge of the sword. They will be led captive into the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles is fulfilled. I want to read you a couple of things from Josephus about, he records all these things. Josephus was a Jewish man who was a general, I believe, in the Israeli army at the time. But somehow, he was... The best I can understand it, the Romans did not try to kill Josephus. He was, you might say, embedded in their camp a lot. They treated him like people in the Middle East right now. You may see journalists. They kind of let journalists alone to some extent, especially if they're wanting publicity. So Josephus was, it appears to me, was that way. The Jews, reads like, hated him during this time because I guess they viewed him as a traitor. Well, Josephus wrote a lot of stuff about this period of time. Now, when I think of the people in Jerusalem being starving to death, I guess the way I've always kind of pictured that was, you know, a man and his wife and kids are sitting around the table and they break up, divide out the last piece of bread and they eat it and they're getting weaker and weaker and they just kind of sitting there and weaker and weaker and they die. There's a lot more things involved in this than that. When this first began to happen, the Jewish military, whatever word they use for that, was fighting the Romans. And a couple of times they got the upper hand. The Romans had to turn back. So there was this military conflict that was going on. The Romans were trying to build an embankment up on the walls. At one point, the Jews dug a tunnel under it, set it on fire, and the thing collapsed. All right, a lot of stuff going on other than just eating your last piece of bread. Let me read a couple of things here. They were a band of robbers who would band together. They were thieves. They were thugs. But they were banded together for protection in numbers, I guess. And would go around inside the Jerusalem, robbing their own people. Robbing them of bread. Robbing them of whatever, mostly things to eat. People weren't that concerned. Maybe at first they may have been robbing them of money or gold or whatever they may have, but as time went on, people weren't worried about their money. They were worried about food. And these robbers would go around robbing people of bread. And now I got to thinking, if I was there with my family and finally came across some food, and I went in our house, I think I would lock the door so nobody could break in and get our food. But Josephus specifically says these robbers, if they go by houses where the doors are shut, they assume they've got food. And they break in and get the food. If they will not tell them where the food is, they dealt with them in torturous ways that Josephus describes, but I'm not, to torture them, to get them to tell where the food is. They would torture people to death for one loaf of bread. People, when they got food, Josephus says, some of them would eat it without grinding, get the corn, they eat the corn without grinding it and making and milling it into flour or anything. But if they did mill it and make bread out of it, he said there would be no play. They wouldn't take time to set the table. Okay, this is not a meal where we're going to sit down and look like we normally do. No place was laid for a distinct meal, but they snatched the bread out of the fire, half-baked, and ate it very hastily. Can you envision that? Children would take the morsels of the bread out of their father's mouths to try to eat them. All right, he goes on. There's a couple of things I want to point out that he says. At first they buried the bodies of the dead, but then it got to be so many that they didn't bother to do that. There are times that they threw the bodies over a certain point place in the wall, so they'd be on the outside of the wall. Josephus says that Titus was making his rounds outside the wall one day and saw these bodies and particularly smelled them. Here's what he says. However, when Titus, in going his rounds along those valleys, saw them full of dead bodies and the thick putrefaction running about them, he gave a groan. And spreading out his hands to heaven, called God to witness that this was not his doing. And such was the sad case of the city itself. Josephus mentions two or three times where it seems like Titus has a little bit of heart to him. And he's telling God, this is not what I had planned. He goes on. Some of the Jews would try to escape from the walls. And I'm not sure how this worked, but sometimes the Romans let certain people go, let them out. And I don't know how the distinction there or not. But there are places where Josephus mentions people tried to escape. And before they would leave, they would swallow gold coins. Now, why would they do that? So if they got away, they could retrieve the coins later. You understand that, I guess? And have something, a stake to start on. To start a new life, they'd have a little bit of money to start a new life. Well, the Roman soldiers, who were brutal, found this out. And so they took these people. Here's what Josephus says. They would cut the pieces out of the Jews' bellies. So they would catch these people, cut them open, go through their bowels to see if they had gold coins in their bowels. And Josephus says, in one night's time, about 2,000 of these deserters was thus dissected. When Titus finds out about this, he is livid. Again, showing you a little different side to Titus, perhaps. And he is angry with the soldiers for doing this. You know, don't you have enough of your own that we're providing you without having to go to this kind of drop to this level? That's what he tends to be saying. A lot of things going on about this that I would have never thought about. That happened as Jerusalem was being destroyed. We get on down to verse 25. And things turn, like take a turn. Verse 25 says, and there will be signs in the sun and moon and stars, and upon the earth dismay among nations, in perplexity at the roaring of the sea and waters, men fainting from fear and the expectation of the things which are coming upon the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Let's stop there a little bit. He talks about the sun and the moon and the stars. And here in Luke, he just says there will be signs. Signs in the sun, moon, and stars. Doesn't particularly say what. But Matthew and Mark do. Matthew says the sun, and Luke says the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and stars will fall from the heavens. Now, and it goes on to say, and then they will see the Son of Man coming in power and great glory in the clouds. All right, now it's at this point where it's very difficult to determine if that happened before the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem or before 70 AD, or if it's something that's going to happen later on. All right. Now, the problem is with verse 32, and I said we're not going to talk about that much, but just for a second, where it says, and these things, or this generation, will not pass away until all things take place. Now, it's hard for me to believe that when the disciples heard Jesus say that, that they think that he means anything else than their own generation. The people who are living right then. That seems to be the obvious explanation. Now, R.C. Sproul makes this statement, and I think this is worth considering, and I've got it written down there. He says, you either have to take the time frames literally and the catastrophic events figurative, or you have to take the catastrophic events literally and the time frame figuratively. But you can't have both. Now let's look at that and see what he's saying. Let's assume that we believe the time frame is literal, that this generation is talking about 40 years or the time of the generation. All his disciples will not be, or that their generation will not be dead and gone before all this takes place. So we're talking about a short period of time, about 40 years, when all this stuff that we're talking about here is going to happen. If that's the case, then we have to look at the Son of God coming in a cloud in great glory in some other way other than literal. Because for all anyone knows, that never happened. Did not happen. So it has to be taken some other way if you're going to keep the time frame literal. If the sun got dark and the stars fell from heaven, if we're going to take that, the time frame, literal, then that has to be explained figuratively in some way. On the other hand, if we want to say take the catastrophic events literally, the stars actually did fall from heaven, the sun did grow dark, the moon did not give its light. If we're going to look at those things literally, the Son of God came in a cloud in great glory, and every eye saw him. Those literal things, then our time frame has to be explained in some other way other than these 40 years. Everybody kind of following that? All right? And that's where the difficulty is. And I'm glad to tell you that I don't know the answer to that. All right? I just don't know. It is interesting, and I didn't find the location of this, but I've read it before in Josephus' history, that during the destruction of Jerusalem, I'm not sure of the time frame, but I think it's before they were destroyed, that it was reported by several people that they saw disturbances in the sky and saw chariots in the sky and a voice from heaven saying, and I don't forget what it was, but it was something like, let us depart from here or something like that. And Josephus even suggests that he didn't know what to think about that, whether to put stock in that or whether it was just a fable or what. He left open room for that never to be the case. But some people have suggested that perhaps God, the Son of God, the Son of Man, was there, coming to exercise vengeance upon the Israelis, upon the Jews. Would God do such a thing? Get down to number 5, down to days of vengeance, that all things may be written, may be fulfilled. I'll go back, that's in verse 22. Now, I'm going to read you some verses. This is going to come from Deuteronomy 28. I think I've got that passage down there. Deuteronomy 28 was a chapter, kind of one of the prominent chapters in the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses tells the people, here's what God said. If I'll read you the first verse. Now it shall be, if you will diligently obey the Lord your God, be careful to do all his commandments, which I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you. And for 14 verses, Moses tells what the blessings of God will be upon the people who will obey God and keep all the commandments. Deuteronomy 28 has 68 verses. The first 14 verses describe ways in which God will bless his people for obedience. The last 54 verses tell of ways in which God will curse his people if they disobey. Kind of lopsided, isn't it? And I'm not going to read them all, but I'm just going to read a few. And as I read them, I want you to see, does this look like 70 A.D.? And all these things, and there's 54 verses of them, all of those things don't have to apply to every person. God may curse your disobedience one way and my disobedience another. He may curse all of us with one common curse for our disobedience. So these are just examples of things that may come about in your life or my life or somebody else's life or our nation, perhaps, because of their disobedience to God. Everybody follow that? Okay, I'm going to read a few. You think, does this sound like Israel? Does this sound like the Jerusalem and the Israelites in the time of the destruction of the temple? Verse 15 is where it starts. I'll read this. But it shall come about, if you will not obey the Lord your God, to observe all his commandments and his statutes, which with I charge you these days, then all these verses shall come upon you and overtake you. Now, why are the curses coming? Because they did not obey. Disobedience. Is that a bad thing? You think it is? Okay, I think, and I'm going to talk about this in a minute, I think we get so accustomed to God not doing anything when we disobey him, that when he does, we cry foul. Right? Let's listen. He says, God will curse you until you are destroyed and until you perish quickly. Could that have been applicable to Jerusalem in 70 AD? Verse 26, and your carcasses shall be food to all birds of the sky, to the beasts of the earth. There will be no one to frighten them away. Jesus made a statement similar to that, where the corpses are, where the dead bodies lie, the eagles or the buzzards will be gathered together. Moses says, one way you may experience the curse of God on you is that the dead bodies will be lying in the streets, the birds will come and get on them, and there will be nobody left to shoo the birds away. He goes on, you will never be anything but oppressed and crushed continually. Does that sound a little bit at least like the Jewish people? You will never be anything but oppressed and crushed continually. He goes on, so all these, about halfway through there, so all these curses shall come upon you and pursue you and overtake you until you are destroyed. Because why? You would not obey the Lord your God. And he goes on. The Lord will bring you a nation against you from afar. Like easily you could see that as the Romans. From the end of the earth, as the eagle swoops down, a nation whose language you shall not understand. A nation of fierce countenance, who shall have no respect for the old or show favor to the young. And it shall besiege you and all your towns until your high and fortified walls in which you trusted come down throughout your land. Then you shall eat the offspring of your own body, the flesh of your sons and your daughters whom the Lord has given you during the siege and the distress by which your enemies will oppress you. That easily took place in the destruction of Jerusalem. He goes on and he talks about a man, he says, a man who is refined and very delicate among you. I don't know what that picture's, what kind of picture that puts in your mind, but to me it puts a picture of a man who is just not he's not soft, but he's just not a villain. He's a responsible man. He says, this man who is refined and delicate among you will suddenly develop, and this is one of the curses, will suddenly develop hostility toward his brother, toward his wife, and his children. You know why he's hostile toward them? Because he is eating his young child, and he does not want to share it with his wife and his other kids. He talks about a woman who is refined and delicate, who is so soft and so easygoing and so gentle that she won't hardly put her bare foot on the ground. It says, in secret, she will go and hide and give birth to a child. And she is hostile toward her husband and her other kids because she wants to eat the afterbirth between her feet and eat her new baby and not share it with her family. This is a curse from God? He goes on. Then you'll be left, here's another curse, you'll be left few in number, whereas you were as the stars in the heaven for multitude, but because you did not obey, he says, God would have delighted in blessing you, but now he will take delight to make you perish and destroy you. Moreover, the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. Is that a picture of the Jewish nation? Not just back then, but even in our day. And among those nations you will find no rest. There shall be no resting place for the sole of your foot. So your life will hang in doubt before you, and you will be in dread night and day. You'll have no assurance of your life. These are things that may happen to people who have been so callous as to not obey God. Have you ever disobeyed God? Have you? Yeah. How often do you disobey God? Too often. Too much. Does God do these things to you? He hasn't to me. And when I read this, I think this is just a little bit harsh. In fact, it's a whole lot harsh. It's hard for me to believe God is taking responsibility for this, but he is. And let this be a caution to you and to me. When I go to looking at things like this that I just read you in Deuteronomy 28, and I think, man, that's just a little over the top. It ought to trigger into my mind that I have become accustomed to mercy. These people, I doubt if they disobeyed God any more than I disobeyed God. Some of them more, some of them less. And yet God cursed them. In our text this morning, I'm wanting to emphasize the destruction of Jerusalem, the things that went on. But I want to suggest to you that no matter how horrid and how terrible those things seemed, perhaps the day is coming when God curses this world, and God destroys this world, and God takes out vengeance upon this world, not just one city, but the world. I told you before, I was raised in a kind of a pre-trib, pre-mill setting in church when I was a kid growing up, and the general idea was, at least the kind of, this was kind of probably a caricature of how it really was. But it seemed like people were, oh, I can't wait for Jesus to come. You know, we get to go be with him in glory. They don't have a clue what they got to go through to get there. When God comes and judges this world, things are going to be terrible. Awful. Some of God's people undoubtedly will be tortured and killed. They already are. All over the world. That's a common thing for all of history. Why on earth would all of a sudden we escape that? There's a terrible day of judgment coming. that may look, make the destruction of Jerusalem look like child's play. Let's pray.